Europe asks Asia, where's the love?
Asia tells Europe, we'll get back to you.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, October 31st, which means it is
Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you, Jeremy. Coming up, how major flooding in Thailand is creating a supply chain slowdown.
A milestone today for the number of people on the planet.
And Yabba Dabba Doo. There's a new restaurant straight out of the Stone Age, Jeremy. I love it.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses and the computer files they depend on. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
Japan's central bank said today if it's going to help Europe with its debt problem, Europe first has to help itself. The rescue package Europe put together last week is relying on foreign help, a lot of it from Japan and China and places like that. China also hasn't said whether it's going to contribute to Europe's bailout fund, and the Chinese want to know what they're going to get out of the deal. One big thing they could get? Technology. Here's Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz.
The EU is China's biggest export market, so the Eurozone crisis is spelling disaster for parts of China's manufacturing sector. But not everyone's worried.
The EU economic crisis, of course, they bring some pressure, obviously challenges, but also bring good opportunities for my work.
Yang Fenghui puts wealthy Chinese investors in touch with European businesses. He's been busy lately. The Eurozone crisis means it's cheaper than ever for Chinese investors to purchase European companies.
Buy the technology or acquire the company or make industrial investment to, for example, to buy some mines, forests and farms. And we have this tendency and we have several projects ongoing.
China's problem is that its companies are big, but they're not global innovators. But when the Chinese buy European companies, they buy core technology, which can give them that missing edge in the global marketplace. And now that Europe needs money, it's a great time for China to make that trade. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, one stock that is not trading this morning is that of MF Global. The brokerage firm, which is run by former New Jersey Governor John Corzine, has seen its stock price collapse in the last week. And trading was halted this morning amid fears about a bankruptcy filing. And those fears have come true. The company has filed for bankruptcy. Here to explain is our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what's going on at MF Global.
Sure. A lot of people haven't heard of MF Global. All you need to know is that it's a mid-sized firm that's involved in commodities, and it's run by John Corzine, who is the former governor of New Jersey and also the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. So what MF did was it loaded up on European sovereign debt, $6.3 billion worth, and now it's paying the price. No one else wanted to buy that debt. MF couldn't dump it, and they've negotiated a bankruptcy or a sale over the weekend. We'll soon know. And the interesting thing here is that MF almost died back in 08, and we saved it. And it came back, clearly didn't learn any of its lessons.
Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Thanks, Heidi. And let's get some analysis now from Julia Coronado, who is chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. She is with us live from New York, as she is every Monday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Julia, is this the possibly the Bear Stearns of the European debt crisis? In other words, are there going to be more financial firms like this that are tied up in European debt and are brought down?
I don't think so. MF Global took a very special interest in European debt, and I don't think a lot of the other American firms have taken a similar view. So I don't expect a lot of fallout to other firms. That said, I do think this highlights the vulnerabilities to the Eurozone crisis, and there are still questions that are circulating and swirling around about the larger countries like Spain and Italy and how they're going to fund themselves into the future.
Well, you mentioned Italy. I have seen a lot of headlines about Italy this morning. What is the latest concern there?
Well, it's just the concern. There was so much optimism after the announcement last week, but as you dig through the details are still yet to be worked out. And so it's still not clear how a country like Italy is going to finance its very, very large deficits going forward. And we're still very much waiting on details, and then there's a lot of balls still in the air.
You're talking about the grand plan that came out last week to deal with the European debt crisis. I noticed one of the things that it called for was help from the Chinese, who haven't said yes yet.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of sort of hopeful ideas about taking the money that Europe has put forward and that the IMF have put forward and leveraging that and getting private investors to come in and put their money up. But of course, that all depends on the terms that you get on the deal. So sure, China might be willing to participate, but they're going to want to get a pretty good return. And is that return enough to, or does that, is it so high that it gets Italy back into trouble? So really a lot of questions still around where we're going to go from here.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks so much.
All right, my pleasure.
All right, $6,999,999,998.
I think we're up to 7 billion now, Steve.
People. My God, there he is. Or she. I don't know where that person is. I don't think anyone really knows. But that, according to the United Nations, is how many people reside on planet Earth as of right now. Marketplace sustainability reporter Eve Troeh is with us now in our Los Angeles studio to talk about population growth and how it affects a country's economy. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning.
So 7 billion folks raises some scary questions about having enough food and water, that kind of thing, right?
Definitely. And we'll hear a lot about that today, I imagine. Environmental impact and risk. But, you know, there can be a positive to this. So what image comes to mind when you think of this story, Steve?
A lot of little tykes being born.
Yes. Yeah. Babies, little ones, whatever you want to call them. Growth means young people. And if you're a fast-growing country like China or India, you have a lot of babies to take care of. Mm-hmm. That means you have to educate them, provide them with health care. And if you invest in them, you get a big, smart, healthy workforce. If you can't afford to do that or you don't do it, those young people grow up to be a burden, not an asset. That's how Jeff DeBelko at the Woodrow Wilson Center put it to me.
With high population growth rates, it makes the challenge of achieving economic growth all that much more difficult.
But on the flip side, no babies is a problem, too.
In Western Europe or Japan, they're experiencing negative population growth. Where are you going to find the labor to run the economy and support the older generations?
All right, Eve Troeh. So how does the U.S. stack up?
Well, it's interesting because our natural growth rate is pretty much at what's called the replacement rate, mm-hmm. 2 kids per female, flat. But because we have so much immigration, we're growing at a pretty fast rate for a developed country. Our overall population growth rate is 0.8%.
0.8%. All right, Marketplace's Eve Troeh on the 7 billion day.
Yes,
Eve, thanks.
Well, as the population of the world goes up, prices are going up at Redbox, DVD rental kiosks, Steve, from $1 to $1.20. At least they're not going up to $7 billion. That would be a little bit expensive.
Awful, yes.
But as Sally Herships reports from New York, Redbox better be careful not to alienate customers like its rival Netflix just did when it raised prices.
Netflix and Redbox are video apples and oranges. Netflix offers a library of movies and TV. Redbox, only new films. Netflix requires membership, and Redbox is pay-as-you-go. The question is, will customers punish Redbox as much for its price hikes?
They will care. They'll look at this as opportunistic.
That's consumer psychologist Kit Yarrow. She says for new customers and spur-of-the-moment purchases, 20 cents isn't a big deal. But when Netflix raised prices, it lost members, some, to Redbox. For those rental refugees, the price hike can be a sore subject.
That they switched over from Netflix and now Redbox is cashing in.
Redbox says this is the first time it's raised prices for DVDs in 8 years. It's passing on costs from a new law that allows debit card companies to charge businesses more for small purchases. The company is hoping to smooth the transition. It's offering a one-month promotion. Certain video rentals at the current $1 price. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business. Carbonite Business is an online automatic backup solution designed specifically for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically and continually backs up computer files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other computer problem, files can easily be recovered. To learn more about Carbonite Business and to receive a free trial, visit carbonite.com and use the code Marketplace.
And now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. Almost 8 months ago, when the earthquake and tsunami struck Japan, we saw the impact that natural disaster had on the global economy, originating from a place where a lot of things are manufactured.
Well, Steve, as it turns out, Thailand is also a place where a lot of things are manufactured. And this weekend, extremely high tides brought Thailand's worst flooding in a half a century to the peak. Now officials are assessing the damage to Thailand and to the global output. For more, let's bring in the BBC's Rachel Harvey, who is in Bangkok. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Rachel, is the worst over, and what do things look like out in the streets of Bangkok?
Well, the government's saying that for the center of Bangkok, the worst could be over, but it is only the center of Bangkok that has been spared. If you look at a satellite image, you see this white blob of Bangkok's center surrounded by a sea of blue. So that runoff water that's moving down from the central provinces has now inundated areas in the northern suburbs, to the west of Bangkok, and areas around the main Chao Phraya River. So there's no real sigh of relief here. It's more a case of, okay, the center's been spared the worst, but there are still people that are going to need a lot of help for a long time to come.
People and businesses. I know a lot of the factories are located outside of Bangkok. What's the impact on global business so far?
Well, it's going to be, I think, medium to long term, pretty profound, although they haven't had a chance to really do a proper damage assessment, and they won't do until the floods recede. But we're talking about at least seven industrial parks that are completely underwater. That means thousands of factories that have had to stop work. It means tens of thousands of workers that are temporarily, at least, laid off. So big concerns. We're talking in many cases about electronics firms and auto industry. So Honda and Toyota, for instance, have been heavily impacted by this. And that, of course, follows on from the Japanese tsunami earlier this year. So they've taken a big hit. Sony, Western Seagate. There are predictions that perhaps hard drive prices might be pushed up by all of this. The supply chains and the factories combined, that causes big problems, not just in Thailand, but also farther afield as well.
The BBC's Rachel Harvey in Bangkok. Rachel, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The Australian airline Qantas just ended a strike that grounded all of its planes, stranding 100,000 passengers around the world.
Reporter Stuart Cohen joins us now from Sydney, Australia, with the details. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, what's it like now? Has the problem been solved, or is it still pretty bad?
Well, it's still going to be a lot of waiting around. Internationally, around 22,000 passengers were stranded. Many are stuck in L.A. and still face delays in getting overseas, and Americans in Australia are facing delays getting home. But there are also other airlines that fly the same route, so at least American travelers have other options.
How did this shutdown come about, Stuart? It seems pretty dramatic to shut down the entire Qantas system.
Yeah, well, Qantas has been locked in months-long contract negotiations with three of its biggest unions. They've been staging a series of work stoppages over the past few months. Qantas's CEO, Alan Joyce, said that was costing the airline about $2 million a day. So instead of letting Qantas, as he put it, die the death of a thousand cuts, he took the rather bold step of grounding the airline to force the issue to a head. Hmm. And it worked. It took just a few hours before the prime minister stepped in and referred the dispute to the country's labor arbitration board. They fast-tracked it, and by late Sunday night, not much more than 24 hours after it all began, they issued an order putting an end to the whole dispute.
Reporter Stuart Cohen joining us from Sydney, Australia. Thanks, Stuart.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, some travelers here in the U.S. were left feeling a little unloved over the weekend. Passengers on a JetBlue aircraft were stranded on a tarmac in Hartford, Connecticut for 7 hours on the tarmac. Many flights to New York's airports were diverted to Hartford, overwhelming that airport's infrastructure.
All due to a big snowstorm along the Upper East Coast that dumped up to a foot or more of snow. Steve, I was in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, and I felt the snow, and I luckily brought a jacket with me. That,
I was in L.A. over the weekend, never felt any
that
snow.
That I never have to use in L.A. Well, today more homes are getting their power restored after that snowstorm. And at its peak, lights were out to nearly 3 million homes across the region.
And some of the damage, Jeremy, was even worse than what Tropical Storm Irene did a couple of months ago. Kurt Nickisch is a reporter at station WBUR in Boston, and he's with us now to talk about it. Hey, Kurt.
Hi.
What are we talking about? The economic cost, not only in your neck of the woods in Boston, but throughout the region?
Well, hard to put a number on it at this point, even though, you know, we've been able to sort of deal with it for a day now, but all across New England, lines down and power out. In Massachusetts alone, 500,000 people without power. And I think it just really took people by surprise. They were sort of in weekend mode. Only 3 weeks ago, we had 80-degree temperatures here. And so in some ways, the cost might be a little bit worse because people just weren't prepared.
Any surprising impacts from such an early storm of the season?
Well, today is 31 October, and all the kids were looking forward to go out trick-or-treating, and a lot of communities have canceled this, you know, seminal holiday, Halloween, because they're afraid to send kids out walking around where there may be power lines down.
It's certainly something you don't think about, getting through the Halloween trick-or-treating in the snow. Kurt Nickisch from station WBUR in Boston. Kurt, thanks.
You got it.
To a place now, Steve and Kurt, where there rarely ever is snow, Lake City, Florida, and a flaming pizza dispute. Back on October 20th, Steve, a Papa John's there was destroyed in a fire, and police are charging two men who just happen to be the managers of the local Domino's.
Oh,
According
no.
to officials, one of the men said he thought with the Papa John's out of the way as competition, more pizza lovers would flock to Domino's, and I bet he's right.
Yeah.
Happy Halloween, Steve.
Happy Halloween, Jeremy.
Here is a tough predicament. You come across a much more original costume at a party.
Or maybe your neighbor is giving out higher-end candy. Don't you have that competition with your neighbors? Their candy is better than my candy.
Or
I don't like that.
Or their pumpkins are carved better.
Yeah, they have like a face, like a really cool, ornate face or something like that. And you've got the little triangles, you know.
Please. Well, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, now those folks may have had a little help.
Doug Gaudreau has been carving pumpkins.
Ever since my dad would allow me to pick up a knife.
And every October, he leaves his job at LA's Natural History Museum to pursue his other love, transforming pumpkins into elaborate witches, Frankensteins, and movie villains for clients like 6-year-old Victoria Castro.
We have to decorate our pumpkin.
She's picking out a pumpkin at a local pumpkin patch with her dad, Edwin.
My daughter has a project out of school. Kind of lazy. Didn't want to do the carving myself, so I thought I'd find someone here.
Doug Gaudreau, who set up shop near the pumpkins, says he gets a lot of business that way. Really complicated designs can cost hundreds of dollars. Sort of complicated, like Victoria's movie villain, about $50. One family gave him 20 for the standard triangle eyes and mouth.
They just didn't want to deal with the mess, and so they sat there while their child watched me do that and 20 minutes.
And LA isn't the only place experiencing a little less Halloween DIY. Bakers around the country say business is up for cupcakes and cake pops with spiders and mummies. And in the Twin Cities, light installer Rob Slosher says hanging Halloween lights is like Christmas in October.
The purple and the orange are just awesome colors for Halloween.
He says his business is up 10% this fall.
People are working hard. The last thing they probably want to do is come home and work on their house.
If they need a little help saving time and maybe mess and hassle there, consumers are gravitating towards that.
Pam Goodfellow is with the firm Big Research. Goodfellow says Halloween spending is expected to be up about 15% this year. She says that's because Halloween is about escape.
You go out and you kind of forget the economy and you throw all cares out the window.
And wake up the next day and search around for someone to take the load off for Thanksgiving. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
You know, we didn't come to work in costume, but a lot of people do that these days, which I think is so funny. And there are always predictions about what the best-selling costumes will be every year. We decided to go to the source.
And that would be Jen Rogolin at Madison Ragstock in Madison, Wisconsin. Jen, hi.
Hi there.
So what are the big costumes this year?
The big costumes this year were definitely zombie costumes. You can be zombie anything, cops and zombie nurses and zombie Mario and Luigi. But we also saw a whole lot of neon. 80s was definitely a big hit this season.
Have there been any trends, Jen, over the last, say, 5 years that have really surprised you?
Well, it's usually, you know, a lot of decade costumes, 70s, 80s, 30s, are always on trend. A lot of people like to just get really, really dressed up, you know, more than they normally would. Pop culture icons are always really big. I've seen a lot of Mario and Luigi's over the last couple of years.
We've talked about that right here on this program. Yes, we have.
Yeah. So always, like, and this can be pop culture from, like, our childhood and then even things that just happened this year. I've seen a lot of Blue Tobias. Well, not this year, but, you know, you get a lot of, like, Blue Tobias was a very popular costume every year. Just little things from TV and movies are always very popular.
Are people making their own costumes this year?
Definitely. In fact, we put a lot of emphasis on building your own costume. We just sort of have all the pieces, and people are able to make a lot of different costumes out of the same kind of thing. We saw a lot of fur coats that can be, you know, pimp jackets to bears, and we saw a lot of overalls that can be, you know, like just Farmer Joe or, you know, again, Mario and Luigi came up a lot this year, so I don't mean to keep referencing that, but...
Well, Jen Rogolin at Madison Ragstock in Wisconsin, thank you so much, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you, too.
Thanks, Jen. You hear us all the time say, let's do the numbers. Well, now it is time to dissect the numbers with a quiz about global stock markets. Let's bring in our quizmaster, Stefan Richter, who is editor-in-chief at theglobalist.com. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy. Ready for today's quiz?
I am ready.
All right. Everybody knows Wall Street. And we also hear every morning when we wake up or when we go to bed about the stock markets in other countries, Germany, UK, China.
Yep.
What about our home market? What percentage of the world's total stock market capitalization, all stocks value, still is in the United States today? Is it A, 70%? Is it just about half? That will be 50%, of course. Is it C, a little under half, say 40%, or is it at this time just a quarter, 25%, the way markets have gone down, of course?
Okay, well, I am going to go with just about half. I think in the financial markets, we're still, I would say, 50%.
You're close, but not quite right. Mm. 50% is a little too high, actually, because if the flight to safety continues, of course, out of emerging markets and, ironically, into the U.S. dollar, not that we feel so safe here these days, then it would be 50%, but that's not where we're at anymore. That's a little in history.
Then I've got to go with C, a little under half, 40%.
That is absolutely correct. We are at 40%, but here's my bonus question for you. That 40%, is that higher or the same level as what the U.S., in a totally different but very important field, global defense spending accounts for? Is our stock market share globally in line with our defense share?
No way, Stefan. We've got to be probably about 70% with our defense.
Not quite. Stock market capitalization, the U.S. share, and the U.S. share of global defense spending are both around 40%, which makes it pretty astounding in terms of a world of parallels.
Stefan Richter is the editor-in-chief of The Globalist. We'll see you next time, Stefan.
All righty. Bye-bye.
And finally, Jeremy, Stefan, haute cuisine, meet hunters and gatherers. In Berlin, there is a new restaurant. It's a French word, sauvage, right? But it's savage is how we call it in English. And it serves only foods that our cave-dwelling ancestors would have enjoyed. The so-called Paleolithic menu includes organic and unprocessed fruits and vegetables.
Wild
that don't
boars
use,
and
yeah, well, it doesn't use sugar, bread, or cheese. All that, the natural stuff, right? Al natural, as they say. There is, however, meat on the menu, as you mentioned. But no Brontosaurus burgers. Yeah, none at all, Fred Flintstone.
Thanks, Steve. Now you've got that song stuck in my head for the rest of the day and probably everyone else who just heard
that.
Yeah,
but we love it, don't we?
We do. Yeah. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. I hope you have a great Monday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media. When you're with the Flintstones, have a party.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.